This is Faster, a podcast by Flow Cycling. In each episode, we interview industry experts to educate you, challenge you, and even change the way you train so you become faster.
Hey, this is John Thorne over at Faster. If you've listened to this show for a while, you're going to remember Dr. Kyle Booth. He is a chiropractor. He has a very unique approach to chiropractic. It's not just bone popping, but they do stuff that's more neurologically based. And he's helped me a ton over the years. He's become a good buddy. We were recently out on a hike in Las Vegas with our wives, and we got into this really interesting conversation about the concept of pain as you age, and using pain as a sign to either move forward or not move forward, and just how to have a more long lasting career as an athlete doing things that we love. I think you're going to really like this episode. I know it's something that is very interesting to me. So check it out and learn how to use pain to help you become a long-standing athlete.
When we're not creating this podcast, we're working on other ways to make you faster. At Flow, we design and manufacture some of the world's fastest cycling wheels that we sell consumer direct to keep more money in your pockets. As a special thank you for listening to Faster, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase. Simply use coupon code PODCAST in all capital letters at checkout. Your purchase will also support our give back initiatives. 1% of all sales supports our Bike for a Kid program, where we provide bikes and helmets for kids in need. We also plant one tree for every wheel we ship as a thank you to our planet. Enjoy the show.
Dr. Kyle Booth, welcome back to Faster. How you doing?
Good. How about yourself, man?
Good, good. You guys getting rain down there?
No, but it's gearing up for it. It's pretty gray
well, it's dark out it's there. It's coming. Kyle and I live in the same city, and it's raining up here right now, so I bet he's going to get it in a little bit. It's moving down his way.
Sweet.
So Kyle and I were out recently on a hike. Kyle's been on the show before. He is a chiropractor in town, new with a group now. You want to tell him about the new company you're with?
Yep. So like you said, chiropractor, got my master's in sports medicine and stuff. So we're very, very focused on more than just crack and pop type chiropractic. We look into the sports medicine aspect, and that definitely requires full body treatment. So, I was lucky enough to transition from my last practice to a practice called Crafted Wellness and Sports Rehab. And that was almost going on 6 months. That is crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
That's pretty nuts. Cool. It's awesome, though. It's been really good.
Yeah. And in our first episode, we talked a lot about like neurological stuff too, because I think you have you say you're not crack and pop. It's somewhat of a unique approach to chiropractic stuff, especially I think in the West. I think it's probably a little bit different in other areas of the world, but here I think it's relatively new, and you're kind of, I would say, on the forefront of that. Definitely has allowed me to get back out and doing things that I couldn't do before. And we were on a hike recently, me and my wife and you and your wife, and we were cruising. We got talking about some things. We're talking about just kind of the idea of pain, and we've been talking a bit about on the show recently longevity. And I'm thinking about longevity as an athlete. You know, when you're young and you are, you know, 15, 16, if you get hurt, you know, it might last an hour. And then, but maybe when you're 80, maybe that's something that never quite goes away, but you still move. So I just kind of want to talk about maybe the evolution of pain as we age, and, you know, how does the body respond to pain when we're young and then as we're older?
That's a good topic. Yeah, I mean, I actually had this really, really unique viewpoint from a patient recently. I think it was his hand. I think it was the back of his hand. He scraped it up super bad, and they didn't actually know if like his skin was going to come back onto the hand. So the doctors put like the salve on it and this like mesh over the top, and it eventually came back, and he, you know, this kind of like he had an epiphany with this. He's like, we're all basically what we see on the movies, these like superhumans that can get holes in us, but then we can actually heal ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it stuck with me because I think that's true. We all have like a little bit of superhuman in us, but it can change over the course of our life, right? If we fill all of our buckets of being healthy, staying active, eating right, all these things, right? I think we become better suited to hold on to that like superhuman ability to heal ourselves. But I guess to kind of like circle back to pain, pain is super usable because it kind of tells us, you know, if we need to push harder, if we need to, you know, pull back a little bit. So the pain-free aspects of things is, it's really a far cry for most athletes because they're always pushing their body, right? If they don't push their body, they're probably not going to kind of keep on progressing with their sport. And pain can kind of give you a barometer of how far you can keep on pushing. When you look at maybe an older athlete versus a younger athlete, we're just more adaptable. We don't have that, we don't have miles of creating unfilled buckets of health. As we go through life, I'm sure we have certain times in our lives when we don't eat right or we don't exercise all the time and stuff, and that bucket starts to lag a little bit. And our body doesn't forget that. It just, it can carry on to the rest of our lives, right? So that's where I see pain being a lot different from a younger athlete to an older athlete. We haven't accrued a lot of miles and we haven't had a lot of empty buckets for a long time when we're young, and we're very, very much more on the superhuman aspect or superhuman spectrum there.
That healing ability is pretty strong. As far as, you know, I think one of the things that I was mistaken about before was that when you have pain, and a lot of people, I've heard a lot of people say this, when you have pain, it means to stop, right? The older I get, the more I get into things, the more professional athletes that I've spoken with. I actually was watching a documentary several years ago. I think it was on one of the, it was a Major League Baseball player, and he said there wasn't a single game that he played where he wasn't in pain. Right. Mm. You think about people that perform at a high level, even if it's just recreational, you know, what is your thoughts and what is your mentality on when is pain a signal to keep going and when is pain a signal to stop?
Ooh, this is a rough question to answer sometimes. And you know, the hard answer is always is going to be dependent on like where the athlete is in their realm of like training and stuff like that. But I always tell people that you use pain as a barometer to, like you said, keep on going or pull back. If it gets sharp, if it's lasting, if it's something that you have to kind of deal with for multiple days after you've been training, probably that's more of like a tissue irritation. If it's something that you experience on the front end of movement, but then it starts to change in your favor as you start to move a little bit more, you start to kind of explore different ways of warming up or tissue prep or any of that kind of stuff, that's when I see it as, hey, you need to pay attention to that area. It's almost like a respect to the area. You've either had an injury there or that tissue has been significantly used recently. So you could use it as a 0 to 10 scale. I usually tell patients, hey, when you're trying to get back into said movement that hurt them in the past, don't get past like a 3. Don't get past a 3 or a 4. If that gives them a little bit of a barometer to flirt with those 1s, 2s, and 3s to see if that goes away as they move more or as they train. That's what you want, because it's not going to be perfect getting back into it.
Yeah. One thing I noticed too, when I was getting back in, getting over an injury, there were certain points where I was feeling pain, but I was pushing through the pain and then the pain would go away. Right. And I think that's almost counterintuitive. Because I think what your brain is trying to do is it's probably trying to prevent you from doing that thing because it knows it's been hurt in the past. But what is a good gauge of saying, okay, well, I know that this hurts right now, but I am trying to get back to a place, or I'm trying to get to a place that I've not been before. How do you use pain in that situation to either use as an indicator to stop or recognize that you have to push through it?
Hmm. So it is a memory. You're kind of right there. Pain is very, very memorable events because it's a what's called like a noxious stimulus. Our brain is very aware of pain, and it can kind of block out all the other symptoms that are going on. When I treat a patient, it's most of the time they talk about their patient that's the most the pain that's the most prevalent. So say they have this incredible neck pain. If that starts to go away, then they'll say, oh, well, I got this, you know, this shoulder pain now, or I got this low back pain now. And it's layers, right? So you get to see, if that starts to go away, they start to unveil like some other issues. I know that's kind of like a little bit of a tangent there. To push through some of that stuff, again, it kind of goes back to how quickly can you recover from that stuff? Your next couple of days after you train and you move, those tissues are very, very important to analyze and to, make note of how quickly you can get back to, kind of a baseline. If you can't get back to a baseline, that means you probably pushed it too far. And when I say back to a baseline, meaning you feel like you can train pretty hard again, or you can train that area to some sort of capacity. If it's you have a strength day that day and you feel like you're not going to even get to 50% of your intensity, like you've already taxed that tissue, and it's probably, you know, more of a pain situation that is not favorable. I don't know if that answers exactly what you were looking for, but
yeah. But in some situations too, I feel like there's almost, once the body has learned that there's pain, especially if it's a long-standing pain, there's almost like this guarding, right? Mm-hmm. I think you can see it in like in specific movement patterns where people are guarded because they feel that there's going to be pain, or the body itself is just trying to stop that. How do you move people beyond the guarding phase where you're trying to get them to move in an efficient movement pattern versus almost expecting the pain and trying to expect a life after treatment without pain?
Yeah. So this is a concept, I think it'd be more of what's called a lateralization. If there's a certain movement that is painful and the brain keeps on recurring that message, hey, whenever you do this movement, so say for you, it was running, we need to figure out a running lateralization, some sort of different strategy to running for a little bit that mimics it, but doesn't irritate it. I'll usually try to think like, how can we create this like similar motions, even if it's not the same load or the same intensity? How do we have the same motions in the same joints, but still make it productive for the patient? Lateralizations, it's a concept I think popularized by a super super good PT in the States. He's more on the East Coast, but he's very open to like a big Rolodex of movements. And when you're trying to get back from an injury to a certain area of the body, you have to have a bigger Rolodex. You have to have a bigger understanding of creating the same motion in the joint, but you don't have to do it in the same manner. You don't have to have the same strategy that you injured yourself with, because that's going to build capacity again.
Okay. There's this other thing that I think about a lot of time too, from an aging perspective, is when you're younger and you're not necessarily active and you're not getting yourself into a state where you ever have any pain, it almost feels as if you're, well, there's no pain, so that's a good thing. But what I've often noticed, I've been to gyms and I've seen a lot of people over the years that have not been active throughout their entire life. And then as they get to an older age, mid 60s, 70s, 80s, I mean, they have walkers. They're in very bad shape at that point. People that are active their entire lives that sort of have this pain that they deal with or they work through, when they age, they actually have less pain, it seems like, than the people that have never done anything. So it's almost like there's a component that in order to have less pain in the future, you have somewhat of a relevant pain now because you are active and you're moving the body. But if you don't, there's like this cliff effect where you just sort of fall off the cliff at the end. You can see it in the gym. You can see a 75-year-old walk in, they can still do all the exercises, and some of them walk in bent like an owl with a walker, right? How do you see pain changing with age for people that work out versus don't work out?
Yeah, it's a kind of like a wisdom to those people that can get to the gym and they're still 75 years old and they can squat to the ground and they can do all these like really impressive movements for their age. But it's wisdom to, I can almost guarantee you can ask any of those people like, hey, have you had like significant like pains and stuff? Yeah. Like they're going to wake up, they're going to have some aches and pains and stuff, but it's the, you know, fill the buckets, make sure you eat well, you sleep well, and you're getting back into the movements. And it's a consistency throughout their whole lives. Most of the time you have a big, big gap. And then it's really hard to get back from that gap of time, you know, to the same consistency that you had before. Of course, you know, there's going to be people that can do that. But say you didn't train or lift or exercise your body for 20 years, and then all of a sudden, you know, your health status falls and you try to ramp that back up. It's, you know, it's very difficult because 20 years have gone by and you've accumulated a lot of bad debt there. And sometimes it's very difficult for them to kind of climb that ladder. So that's what I see as a difference between the people that have moved and haven't moved over the course of their lives. It's one, the consistency. So their body builds up a capacity and a tolerance to a lot of movement and a lot of ability to overcome aches, pains, and push through those little things to make movement happen on a routine basis. And then the other people, they don't have that resilience. That's a big mindset difference between those two. They feel the first onset of pain, and then they start to shy away from that movement. And that's just makes your movement box more and more small. When we talk about a Rolodex of movements, you want to have the biggest Rolodex possible because that makes you the most adaptable to your environment around you. Mm.
What are your thoughts on pain being masked or managed with things like steroid injections or, you know, use of anti-inflammatories or even things that are stronger than that? Is that creating a bad movement pattern because the pain, or is that allowing a bad movement pattern to continue because you're masking the pain? Are you more of a believer of this is the pain, let's work with it, let's keep a good movement pattern and work through it? Or what are your thoughts on, you know, masking pain?
So you said something kind of interesting about, you know, the movement being correct kind of, or not, I forgot how you just raised it, but, that always kind of, brings my attention back to, I don't believe that there's a perfect way to move. I don't think that's possible to categorize people as perfect movers, or, you know, good or bad. I think there's that specific person and that specific anatomy. And if they can move well, or they can move a lot, then that's pretty dang good movement. And then you got to build up capacity from that. The capacity aspect is very slow sometimes. So say you're trying to increase your amount of mileage ran and you're coming back from a tendinopathy in your lower leg, like an issue in your lower leg, a tissue issue. If you go at it very, very quickly and aggressively, those things can probably linger for a lot longer. If you have a methodical way of increasing slowly, staying within your capacity and building that slowly, you're going to find resolve with that most of the time. So it's sometimes a really, really unfortunate amount of time. But that's kind of the card. Sometimes you have to make sure that you give your body time to have that adaptation that is within your capacity.
Have you worked specifically with older individuals that have masked pain throughout their lives versus those who haven't? And is there a difference as you age?
Unfortunately, I stumbled upon the stat of the Veterans Administration. I'm not trying to like point fingers here or anything like that, but they're the number one prescriber of opioids, mm-hmm. I think on the planet. Don't quote me by any means, but you know, I treat a lot of veteran patients too, and I think most of the time they're given things that mask the pain, and I don't think they get to learn how to deal with it and get that wisdom that that 75-year-old, you know, sometimes can get with moving with pain and trying to overcome that. I think it's pretty easy access sometimes to get those opioids and you know, stuff that we talked about, but and that's not to say that you can't use that stuff to get out of pain, but I think we become abusive with it when it's been long standing and nothing's changed. You know, that pain is still very present, and it's almost like a crutch for people to kind of numb out their life. It's not a good long-term solution. It is a very, very effective short-term solution for pain, especially when you're near acute phases or when you're like really trying to attack a pain. It's a useful tool, but you always have to make sure you kind of keep on looking back to see if it's needed, or you can start tapering that stuff off, because you have to learn how to handle pain and how to control it with your mind. And I know that I don't want that to sound like woo-woo or anything like that, but it's a learning process. And if you just don't have any inputs from your body, then it's hard to learn from it.
Okay. And what about things like, I don't know if you've worked with people that you know that have taken performance enhancing drugs, things like steroids or EPO or anything like that. There's what I've learned is there's this concept of scarcity versus abundance, right? So if you're looking at it from a longevity perspective, if you're putting yourself in a state of scarcity, there can be specific benefits for longevity. However, if you do things like steroids, you feel great in the moment, but the long-term effects of those actually have a deteriorating effect on the body. Have you worked with anybody and noticed as people age, people that have used performance-enhancing drugs versus those that haven't?
Yeah, I mean, you're rob Peter to pay Paul. That's the concept with a lot of those types of interventions, I think, or this is what, you know, what I believe. If we accelerate the body's abilities beyond normal physiologic measures, then we're going to have something is going to give, or something is going to be taken away from in the body, right? So if we have a lot more multiplication of cells, if you look at the telomere concepts, they shorten as you
explain telomere.
Telomere, it's a measure of a cell's the amount of replications that they have. I'm not good at describing that. It's something that I kind of know.
Enough said.
Based off of,
it's better, yeah. More than I knew already.
Yeah, so it's a tough one. Think of it like a rope, and every time you cut a chunk of rope off, you're spending a replication cycle. So you only have a certain given amount of rope, and you can extend that rope if you eat well, blah, blah, do all these things, and then you can have smaller chunks based off of how healthy you are. But, you know, if you're given a certain amount of rope and you keep on accelerating that, you know, using steroids or using something that is like making the body replicate at a faster rate, I think you're going to end up having an error somewhere in those chains, or you're going to run out of rope. And I think that's what we have with, you know, people that are in steroids and they just start kind of breaking down later on in life.
So you see that like with patients, people, they break down easier as they age.
I mean, yeah, there's plenty of things that you can look at for, or stories that you can look at that, you know, people go heavy into certain performance enhancing drugs and later on something gives, right? It's the heart, it's the neurologic system, it's something that goes awry because they've had so many replications and they've used up so much so quickly.
Do you have any experience with like testosterone clinics where they're basically looking at the male norms and then boosting people up to those norms? Do you have any insight on that?
I'm definitely not the authority kind of in that, but, or, you know, have a ton of experience. Whenever I have these types of questions, there's a gentleman by the name of Mike Mahler. He's a very He's a really cool dude. He lives here in Vegas. And he's my go-to on that expert kind of testosterone enhancing, and making that like a very natural approach versus, pumping it up with synthetics and stuff like that. But, I don't know if I have enough, knowledge on that to speak on it.
I might need a word. I might have to try and get this guy on the show. It sounds like an interesting
discussion.
Yeah,
you guys would totally have some really good conversations. He's a very, very well-informed guy. You can constantly see him putting out research and, well, not putting out research, but digesting research and putting it in his own thought process and stuff. So speak very highly of him.
Very cool. So if you think about athletes, basically we do sport because we enjoy it, right? You're a mountain biker. You love mountain biking. You probably mm-hmm. want to do that until you're old, right? I mean, I do a lot of things.
Forever.
I want to do them. Yeah, exactly. Right. So I read this interesting book recently, called Outlive by Peter Attia. One of the things he talked about was, as opposed to training for a specific event, what he says he's trying to do is basically train for like the decathlon of life, basically, mm-hmm. which allows him to, at an older age, be able to do a number of things that he still enjoys. What do you believe are some of the key fundamental things that people need to do in order to maintain the ability to do a sport that they love into the older age?
So I actually thought about this earlier today. And I think a lot of times, when you're training for whatever it is that you want to do in life, you got to put blinders on, to things, to people around you that are doing it. There's always going to be someone that's better than you, right? So if you chase someone so aggressively, or you chase a number so aggressively, you probably outkick your coverage, a lot of times with, pushing too far, pushing too, too much too soon. So if you can really focus on you, and getting these things that we've spoke about so far, focused on, you focus on what happens after training, what happens to your pain levels, and you're doing some of your checkups with blood work and things like that, you have a better barometer. So you can't always look at chasing someone down. Obviously you have goals and you have numbers that you want to hit, but that can't be the only thing. You have to look at it a lens of what your body's capabilities are at that point, and where your goal is at, and try not to kind of outkick your coverage for making those things possible later on.
Do you have any insight as to when people, if they're active their entire lives, at some point we all have to accept the fact that we start to decline in performance, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to hit our pinnacle. Men, women, it's all sort of a thing that happens. What do you have any knowledge or experience on when you can expect a pinnacle and a decline, and how to manage yourself after you start to decline to make sure that you can stay active?
I think they said like for males, it's like pinnacle is like what, 27 or something like that for certain, like explosive, sports and stuff like that. And then you kind of just try to maintain as long as you can. I think in your realm with like looking at endurance, I think that number's pushed out quite a bit further because of the, the performance aspect and the build, right? It takes a lot longer for you guys to, build in terms of endurance athletes, right? But, an endurance athlete, I don't think is as springy as a explosive athlete. An explosive athlete has a different type of collagen fibers and stuff throughout their body that are a little bit more springy. With an endurance athlete, you have stuff that's probably a little bit more durable, has a lot more repetitive use, capabilities. So, I think those are different. When you come back to the question you're saying, when is that? And, how do you deal with it? I don't know when that's going to be for certain athletes. It probably really depends on as you're developing, what buckets you fill and how often you're filling all those buckets. And then, to deal with it mentally, or deal with the psychology of that as an athlete, you have to have someone that can kind of step back and actually look at the situation, and, you know, be coached. It's okay to ask for help and be coached, because those types of situations allow you to look at it from a different lens. You know, if you feel like you're starting to slow down in whatever sport it is that you're going for, and you don't want that to happen, there might be certain ways that you can kind of keep that, that trajectory going forward. But, sometimes it's out of your hands to really figure that out. Getting coached is a really good way to seek that help out.
Do tissues change as we age? I know they do, but do they change in a way where they're, I mean, I think it's kind of this mindset that I've had. You know, you look at people that are older, as grandparents age, a lot of that generation wasn't very active and they sort of become brittle. They fall, they break their hip. There's a whole list of things that can happen. Is that more, a sign of somebody that's been inactive their entire lives, or are the tissues changing so much that we do expect things to break and break down easier?
I think as you develop, you definitely kind of change the way your tissues are laid down, the types of tissues that you have. So, some people would say that the beginning of your life would probably set a big, precedence for how the rest of the life is going to be for your tissues. So if you're someone that is, you know, not very active in the beginning of your life, later on in life, it's going to be a lot harder for you to kind of change your makeup. You know, the makeup of your body is going to be adapted to something, during your adolescence, that there's a lot of change going on during that time. And your body starts to lay down certain foundational, tissues and stuff like that. And I think that's how it starts to understand how to lay down those tissues from your adolescence or from from that time that you're having a lot of changes in your body. And then later on in life, it'll go back to, you know, that again. It'll keep on replicating those tissues because that's how it knows how to do. That's how it knows how to lay that stuff down.
One other thing I think is interesting when you talk about young, adolescent, even toddler age, I'm listening to this really interesting book right now. It's called Raising Mentally Strong Kids. Just came out a couple of days ago, actually.
Why would you be reading that, John?
Yeah, I have a toddler and a young boy who's very active. But one of the things they talk about is they talk about how the brain, when it's young, has these myelin. They have basically the neural pathways aren't formed, and then it lays down myelin to basically create these neural pathways. And one of the things they talked about through, I think it's what the guy's name is, Charles Fay. I think he's done a ton of brain imaging, one of the most in the world. And they show that these kids that are very active when they're young lay down this cognitive layer of movement and movement patterns and the ability to be athletic. And kids that don't have any of that experience, once that those myelin sheaths form, it's very difficult for them to learn proper movement patterns and to become athletic because they've basically lost that in their early developmental years. It's like a language, right? I mean, I can learn a second language when I'm young, but when you get older, it's much more difficult to do. Same thing with like playing a musical instrument. So I just find that interesting. What you're saying is, as you age, you know, there are differences in tissue, but if you've kind of missed that window while being young to even get the ability to have the ability to move properly or be athletic, I can see that being a major challenge. So I think it's just another thing, like for kids to be active and move, sets them up for a lot of success in the future.
Yeah. They get like you said, these neural pathways that they learn and know how to use and they can access, throughout the rest of their lives. Cause they are, like we said, we're going through a lot of adaptations during those years. So you start to learn what your capabilities are or what you can call on to make a movement happen. And, what's called neural plasticity. I think that declines probably over, our lives. Neural plasticity meaning the ability to make your nerves kind of moldable, in the beginning, probably super, super high. You know, you can make all these pathways, neurologic tissue can, grow into, a lot of different pathways younger in your lives. And then later on, I don't think that stimulus is, strong enough to get that to happen. And I'm sure, like, someone will, you know, totally prove me wrong, guaranteed. Like that's 100% going to happen. But I think if we're just speaking in generalities, it's just a lot harder to get that stuff to happen later on. You know, you want to set the foundation as young as possible with being able to move and getting them to be as diverse in movement as possible. I that's what I believe.
Thinking about neural pathways and the ability for things to change, you look at pain, I mean, this is a neurological response, right? There's a nerve that's getting, there's pain sending a pain signal to the brain. If we've had a long-standing injury where we're used to that pain and we have to kind of get over that pain, is that basically a negative neural pathway being formed to create that pain memory? Is that how that works?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's called a sensitivity. Most of the time, because it's this nerve has conducted this signal for so long, the brain accepts that as like a normal signal. And the nerve can kind of keep on firing that signal until it's proven otherwise. And that's when we're talking about having multiple ways to influence pain. You know, your chiropractic adjustment, your soft tissue, your exercise, your whatever intervention it is, you're trying to figure out a way that nerve starts to feel something significantly different. And then it starts to wonder again, like, hey, what's going on in this area? This isn't just the norm. So that's when the brain can kind of start exploring what's going on in those areas again. And if you combine that with, you know, a really nice feel of movement and something that is successful, that's when the brain starts to go, oh, maybe this isn't that chronic pain, or that pathway doesn't have to have that same signal over and over again. And you desensitize those things by creating a positive or a favorable attachment to a movement as opposed to a negative.
Cool. Listen, man, you're always a wealth of knowledge. I definitely appreciate having you on. I know you've definitely helped me get over a lot of stuff. And like I say, if anyone's ever in town, Crafted Wellness, check them out. It's an awesome place. They do a lot of great stuff. You have a couple docs down there, right?
Yep. Yeah, me and Dr. Freeman, potentially going to keep on growing this the next year. So
good for you, man. Listen, always happy to have you on here. I'm sure I'll see you soon. We'll go for another hike and talk about something else fun to talk about.
Oh yeah. Maybe we'll hit the ski slopes together.
That's right, man. We got to get out. All right, man. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to Faster. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Leave a review or teach a friend what you learned today. For more great episodes on getting faster, subscribe to this podcast. While you're on your next ride, be kind to one another and ride safe.